Tell All the Truth by Emily Dickinson. Tell all the truth, but tell it slant. Success in circuit lies, too bright for our infirm delight, the truth's superb surprise. As lightning to the children eased with explanation kind, the truth must dazzle gradually, or every man be blind.
So it was with some misgivings and a little bit of trepidation that I took Richard Stromer up on his suggestion that I should speak to you today on Mother's Day about motherhood. First of all, I don't think there's anything about motherhood that I could tell anyone in this room, mother or not, that you don't already know. I've been a mother now for 20 months, 2 weeks, and 4 days. And while the experience has, as promised, scoured my heart, blown my mind, and kicked my ass down the street and around the block, while it has done all that, what I also know is that it isn't even really hard yet. At least it hasn't been for me. The really hard parts, the white knuckle stretch of this ride, is coming. So who am I, still cruising up the slow part of the roller coaster, still looking out and kind of enjoying the scenery, who am I to speak to you about motherhood? First point. The other little hesitation I had was that I didn't want to talk about motherhood. I wanted to talk about church and my need for church, why I need it. Many of us here have embarked on the journey of building a new religious community, and I am one of them, tentative and fearful and veering in and out of touch with the reasons why I signed the membership book a few months ago. I just finished reading Christopher Hitchens' new book, God Is Not Great, How Religion Poisons Everything. My mother left it behind, actually. My mother, who has simultaneously joined the Episcopal Church after decades of unbelief and started reading Christopher Hitchens. I can't put those two things together in my mind. So I read that book, and I was sympathetic to pretty much all of the arguments that he made about the damaging effects that organized religion can have on people. And even so, I found myself wanting to answer back to him, yes, but you're missing the point. So I'm going to try to do both of those things. I would like to talk to you today about my need for church, and I'll do it through the particular lens of motherhood. So I'm going to tell you a bad mother story, starring me. The first time I hurt my child was on the morning of December 21st, 2008. It was a Sunday, and I was bustling around the house getting ready for work. It was a big morning. I was getting ready to conduct a big piece of music, Gloria by John Rutter. I had an orchestra arriving at church in 45 minutes. I was running late. I had a million details swarming through my mind, right? Chaos. I left something hot on a countertop which I swear to you only the day before my son had not been able to reach. And sure enough, I was standing right there when, in an instant, he zoomed into the room, swiped his hand up on the countertop, and pulled it down on himself. He got burned. A red welt bubbled up on his soft baby skin on the inside of his forearm. And he screamed and screamed, and our lives came to a stop as we rushed to him. And I had to go. So I thrust my wailing baby into my husband's arms, and we exchanged a little terse few sentences. Take him to Kaiser, I'll call you when I can. And I left. So there you have it, motherhood in a nutshell. I wounded my child, and then I abandoned him. As it happened, the burn was not severe. It healed properly, albeit very slowly, over the course of several months. And he has a souvenir. He has a little red scar on his arm. We call it his boo-boo. Will actually got quite interested in his boo-boo. Among other things, it was a great way to get attention. For a long time, he would hold up his arm and issue the royal command, "Kiss boo-boo." I drew a parallel boo-boo on his baby doll's arm with a red Sharpie, and he got interested in undressing the baby doll and finding the baby's boo-boo. And we would go through magazines with red pens and draw boo-boos on the arms of people in magazines so that everybody could have one. It became sort of a game to him, this fellowship of the boo-boo. And it was fun. My reaction was, shall we say, a little different. To accurately describe how I felt about what I thought I had done, about my negligence, my carelessness that had resulted in the injury of my beloved boy, I will need to refer you to a movie which you may or may not have seen. This is a film from a few years back called Breaking the Waves. Anybody in here seen this movie? If you haven't seen this movie, I urge you, by all means, don't. Please, I beg you. It is one of the most unrelentingly sad movies I've ever seen. We had to watch it in 10-minute increments. We couldn't stand it. Anyway, the opening scene of Breaking the Waves, this movie, is a funeral. There are a handful of mourners standing around an open grave on the cold, barren shore of the North Sea. The gray sea blends into the gray sky. The biting wind whips around the black garments of the Calvinist Scottish elders who are standing around the grave. They are laying a member of their community into the earth. And here's what they say. "Andrew McPherson, we damn your soul to hell forever." They go on to say that they hope he will find no rest, that they hope he will burn for all eternity for the crimes that he committed while on earth. And then you hear the sound of cold shovelfuls of wet sand hitting the coffin. The scene has stayed in my mind for several years, ever since I saw that movie. It's become a kind of grim joke around our house. I use it as a kind of emotional shorthand for certain mental states I can get into. I can say to Dave, my husband, "I'm having a break in the waves moment here, Dave." And what that means is that I am feeling like both the dead man in the grave and the elders standing around the coffin. I am both the condemned man down there in the earth and the unforgiving self-appointed tribunal. So that's how I felt about the boo-boo. I have played this dual role for years, but nothing has honed my skill at it like motherhood. I say to you again that I think I'm not telling you anything you don't already know. But the truth is that becoming a mother has given me a kind of superhero X-ray vision. I can look around with my keen new eyes at human life on planet Earth, at all of us, and I see more clearly than ever before that what we live in, the atmosphere in which most of us live and move and have our being every waking moment of every day, is a thick miasma of judgment. We live in it as in a noxious green gas. This is how I see it. Everything we see or say or do or taste or touch is coated in this green gas of evaluation and judgment. I like it. I don't like it. He's right. She's wrong. That was bad. Hey, you got it right. That was a mistake. Good job. You fucked up. We damn your soul to hell forever. Right? So this is where I went automatically in my mind as a reaction to what was, after all, what turned out to be a fairly minor accident. There's a groove carved in my brain. It's called self-recrimination. It's really deep, and it's got steep, sloping sides so that any thought rolling across the surface of my brain can just fall right into it. Right? The automaticity of it, the massive force of decades of habit, can make it invisible, can make me kind of unaware of it, the way we become unaware of habits. I had a funny reminder of this at the Trader Joe's the other day, of all places. I was standing in the checkout line with my boy, and I was trying to do four things at once, right? I'm packing groceries with one hand, and I'm doing my PIN number with the other hand, and with my spare pair of arms, I'm trying to keep my son from simultaneously stabbing himself in the eye with a ballpoint pen and breaking a bottle of wine over his head, you know. So I'm there like Sheba with all my arms. And apparently I was talking to myself out loud, because that's what you do as a mother. You just mutter to yourself all the time in public. And I was keeping up a kind of a running commentary, and the checker looked at me with this great look of compassion, and he said, "You really got to ease up on yourself." Like, what was I saying? I don't even know. And he pointed to Will, and he said, "He's listening. The guy at the Trader Joe's, Buddha, there at the Trader Joe's." Motherhood makes you so vulnerable. It strips you so bare. You can see a lot from that place of vulnerability. What it has allowed me to see, not like I never saw it before, but to know the truth of it, to let the truth slice straight down into the bone, is that most of us have this running commentary going most of the time, whether we say it out loud or not. We perpetuate an everyday climate of violence against ourselves and each other in ways large and small. The early months and years of first-time motherhood is an excellent vantage point from which to see this, since everything you either choose to do or are forced to do is shrink-wrapped in that asphyxiating plastic of judgment. Did you breastfeed your child or not? Could you breastfeed or not? How long did you breastfeed? Do you let your child cry himself to sleep? Did you run to your child every time he cried? Are you at home with your child? Did you put your child in daycare? And on and on and on. I have had the good fortune to be in a couple of really wonderful mothers' groups where we've been able to really share and talk pretty openly about our experiences and feelings. And I have seen my friends in these groups break down and weep uncontrollably because of their belief that somehow they had failed their baby, that they had not done the optimal thing. The fear and self-punishment can be crippling. All of us have inherited these habits of thinking and speaking and being. There's a deep groove of self-recrimination carved into the universe, and we just rolled into it. And if we do not actively struggle to make new channels for the streams of love, these habits will kill us. This is why I need church. I have come to understand that for myself, in the limited scope of my own life, the meaning of nonviolence and the search for peace have come down to the question of how to cope with our evaluating and judging selves. I was thinking about this, and this quote from Rumi popped into my head. I know it's been bandied about in Unitarian circles before. The quote is, "Out beyond ideas of wrongdoing and rightdoing, there is a field. I'll meet you there." How many people have ever heard that before? Okay, I have to tell you that I hate this quote. I hate it. It is pithy and pat, and it makes it sound so easy. It's like, the field is right over there. See you there. Five minutes. Get you there in 5 minutes. It makes it sound so easy. And it provides no map for how to get there. It's like saying to someone, if you don't like being poor, I'll tell you how not to be poor. Just go out and get yourself $1 million, and then you won't be poor anymore. Solution. Rumi may well be waiting for me out there in the field, but I am stuck between the Scylla and Charybdis of right doing and wrong doing, right? I'm just stuck there. Right, wrong, right, wrong. There's an old joke that everybody talks about the weather, but nobody does anything about it. Sometimes I feel like everybody in the religion racket talks about peace, but nobody does anything about it. I've been around the religion racket for a long time, and sometimes I feel like I'm not making any progress. Becoming a mother has made me deadly serious about finding and being peace. I'm out of time for anything else. And so are you, actually. I've come to understand that for me, for my limited little span of life on earth, real peacemaking is not so much the prophetic Julia Ward Howe get up on the barricades with a bullhorn type of thing, originally I thought for this service we would read the Julia Ward Howe speech because I love it and just remind us that Mother's Day had its origins in pacifism and protest. And then I thought, you know, I'm just, for me right now, it's more private, it's more internal, it's more personal, and actually much harder than that. Real peacemaking means working on toning down the aggression against myself and others that happens on a daily, hourly basis every time I pass judgment. It means working, probably for the rest of my life, on acceptance and clear seeing, truth-telling, and compassion. And this question of how to tell the truth makes me want to tell you one more thing about Will and his boo-boo. I told you that he got over it pretty fast, that he, you know, liked it and it became this cool game for him. But there was one incident where that wasn't true. I took him to the YMCA a while back and I put him in child watch while I went off to take my first yoga class in like a year and a half. I was going to take 1 hour for myself. In 18 months, I was going to take 1 hour. And he had never been in child watch before. So I spent most of that hour, I came away a little bit before the end of the hour, and he was in an unfamiliar place, he'd never been there, you know, there was Barney blaring really loud on the television, which was really foreign to his experience, and when I went to collect him, he was standing in the middle of the room sobbing as if his heart had been broken, sobbing. He ran up to me and he grabbed my knees, and when I picked him up, he held up his forearm and said, "Kiss Boo Boo." And Boo Boo was like 6 months old at this point, right? So his Boo Boo did not hurt. What hurt was something that he didn't have the words for. He was telling me the truth, I heard. But he told it slant. The little red scar was just a stand-in. He couldn't say, "You left me. I thought you were gone forever. I'm so scared. And who is that big blue dinosaur over there? I don't get it." All he could say was, "Kiss Boo Boo." And this is what we do too. We do the same thing. Someone says, "How are you?" And we'll say, "I didn't sleep very well." Or, you know, sciatica's kind of acting up. Or, "Well, I'm hanging in there, I guess." It's the equivalent of, "I got this little boo-boo." But it's a stand-in. It's a stand-in for something else. Too often, the truth is not something dazzling and wonderful, as in Emily Dickinson's poem, but something too painful to be publicly acknowledged. It's like we're all pictures of the people in the magazines, and we all have the little boo-boo. Church, for me, what I want it to be, is the place where we practice creating a climate of acceptance and kindness, so that more and more of the whole truth of our lives can be shared with each other. When I was in graduate school and I had passed my PhD orals, I had to sign a document, I love this, promising the university that my dissertation research would not entail experiments on live human subjects. I was in the English department. Okay. And I didn't. But really, that's what church is. That's what we're doing here. We are performing experiments on live human subjects, on ourselves and on each other. We come together to create a set of conditions to try to see if we can grow a little compassion, like in a petri dish, to see if we can see and tell a little bit more of the truth, a little bit more of that dazzling light that's out there. And we're looking for reproducible results, right, like good scientists. So we come back and we recreate the same conditions again and we try to do it again. And then we come back the next week and we do it again. And slowly, over time, as the force of habit takes hold, we may find, I hope we will find, that when we've rolled back down into that grand canyon of judgment and self-righteousness, that we're able to climb out, that we're able to help each other out, that we're able to encourage and support each other to be and become our best selves. I hope that we will be able to practice being honest, or getting a little more honest, about ourselves and about each other I hope we can do it with compassion. I hope we can take Thich Nhat Hanh's advice, look each other in the eyes and say, I'm that too. This is the kind of church I want. This is what I really want for Mother's Day. If we can be a community that practices together, if we can understand and apply even 1% of all the good advice that's out there in all those holy books, if together we can create and sustain new habits of peacemaking, then I will have gotten what I wanted for Mother's Day. I need church today on Mother's Day, and I need it every day, because I need to make new channels for the streams of love, and I can't do it alone. And I hope you'll help me. Amen.